Blessed be the darkness, the vast expansion, the all-encompassing, all-surrounding womb of space. Blessed be the light, the penetrating point, the all-focusing, all-aligning core of creation. Blessed be the blade that divides the darkness from the light, thus generating duality, and from duality is all substance formed. The cleansing by water, the purity of salt, combining together, so merged we exalt. By the blade that separates the darkness from the light, the babe from the mother, and the world of the living from the realms beyond, I conjure this circle as a sacred place, shifting the confines of time and space, an island apart and a fortress between yesterday's sorrow and tomorrow's dream. Blessed be the vessel wherein the divided may unite.
Welcome to the 11th episode of the Covening Podcast. I am your host, Lady Sitara. I've updated the covening.org website so that now podcast descriptions are on the podcast page next to the link for each podcast. I've also put links on the resources page to some good resources for the old religion, including pagan news sources, social services, and some very unique retail. On the transcripts page of covening.org, you can find the recipes for Cakes for the Queen of Heaven, which I hope you baked for tonight's full moon, and my vernal equinox ritual. In the first 8 episodes of the Covening Podcast, I presented some of the basics of early coven training and ritual. In the 9th episode, I explained how I discovered the goddess and the goddess within Wicca. In the 10th episode, I present you with the vernal equinox ritual, which is the second Sabbat ritual that you have attended at my coven. In this 11th episode, I will review the relationship between windblown tradition and Wicca, and then do a deep dive into Hittites and Jew witches. In the 12th episode, next week, I will be switching topics again and do a deep dive into magical shadow work and banishings. It may seem like the wrong time of year for that, but actually, I wanted to wait until we were approaching vernal equinox to make sure that there was sufficient sunlight before tackling this topic. As I am preparing this episode lesson, we are about to experience the March full moon, alternately known as the chaste moon, seed moon, plow moon, and worm moon. In the Pacific Northwest, we are noticing the daffodils and crocuses blooming, the tulip leaves are showing, but the tulips have not yet bloomed, and the rhododendrons are budding. The native people who lived in the Pacific Northwest, especially the coastal Salish, did not depend on celestial observation for their calendars. They couldn't, because the Pacific Northwest, the temperate rainforest, was frequently covered in mist and clouds. So yes, they observed the moon, sun, planets, and stars when they could, but earth signs were more reliable. That was the sound of a varied thrush, also known as an Alaskan robin. The varied thrush winters in the Pacific Northwest, and for about 3 to 4 weeks before they vacate the Pacific Northwest to return to Alaska, we hear their beautiful haunting sound in the early morning. That was the song of the white-crowned sparrow, the cheerleader of spring. Like the changing of the guard, the varied thrush leaves, and the white-crowned sparrow arrives in the Pacific Northwest. and that was the sound of a male northern flicker drumming. That is a mating call. The northern flickers are year-round residents in the Pacific Northwest, but their mating drumming begins in the late winter and continues through the spring. Of course, the native pussy willows have also bloomed, but I can't present those to you on audio. This year is a little different. Bird flu has hit the Pacific Northwest. Bird flu is carried by, and very contagious in, waterfowl. And the Pacific Northwest is surrounded by water, sounds, estuaries, and sloughs. I did not hear as many varied thrush songs this year as I usually do. Bird flu has hit the USA and the world, worst in places that host a lot of waterfowl. Somewhat north of the Seattle area, closer to Bellingham and further north, great flocks of snow geese fly. So great are those flocks that when they take flight, en masse, they sound like 10 large airplanes lifting off and 20 semi-trucks revving their engines all at once. I'm wondering what those flocks will sound like this year. This upcoming full moon, with the sun in Pisces, mutable water, and the moon in Virgo, mutable earth, because it is an eclipse, is also called a blood moon. Blood moon refers to the color of the moon during the totality of the eclipse, when the sun, earth, and moon align so perfectly that the earth is exactly between the sun and the moon's reflection of the sun is dimmed, and the color we observe is caused by the Earth's own atmosphere. The full moon eclipse totality will last for approximately an entire hour. The Pacific Northwest, in theory, would be the best place to observe this totality because ours will begin around 11:30 p.m. Thursday night and end at 12:30 a.m. Friday morning. In other words, our totality will span over midnight, the best time to be under the full moon. Whether we can see it or not is another matter. That will depend on cloud cover. I have already provided you with the Cakes for the Queen of Heaven recipe on the Covening.org transcripts page. Episodes 1 through 4 of the Covening podcast cover a sample complete full moon ritual, including all the gesture and movement notes. At the beginning of episode 9, I provided some alternative full moon pieces that relate specifically to Ishtar, so you should be set for the full moon. In episode 10, I presented one possible way to celebrate spring equinox. But there are other ways, and if you have something else in mind, there are plenty of other good sources available, both in books and online. It is my personal opinion that every neo-pagan should have some familiarity with Hittites. And maybe sometime, not in my lifetime, that will be true. Perhaps the problem is that I have not yet published the book on Hittite witchcraft. Hittite is such a huge topic that I can only begin to scratch the surface here, but I will at least present you with the arguments as to why I believe every neo-pagan should be interested. Before cups existed, that is, before there ever was a congregation of Unitarian Universalist pagans, I had a friend who was raised Unitarian, and she explained to me that Unitarianism was Protestant, but not necessarily Christian. That idea boggled my mind, because I had been taught that Protestant churches were Christian churches that had broken away from the Catholic Church during Reformation. And my friend explained that Unitarianism was Protestant because the church was formed during the Protestant Reformation, but that it was not necessarily a requirement to recognize Jesus as Lord and Savior, although many members do. So therefore, Unitarianism itself was not necessarily Christian. I'm going to make an analogy here. Windblown was formed by four elders, each of whom had some training that could ultimately be traced back to the Gardnerian or Alexandrian lines. At least two of the elders also had training in witchcraft that was not off the Gardnerian or Alexandrian lines. And when we formed our original coven, Thistledown, in Hudson Valley of New York in 1982, we used and modified the teachings we had learned from all our parent covens. Windblown is absolutely a collection of covens, solitaries, and couples who acknowledge and revere a mother goddess as well as other gods of nature. Beyond the few earmarks of our tradition, each coven is an autonomous unit. I am only using my voice as an authority because I was one of the original four founding members and because I wrote most of the material that I am presenting here. Windblown is pagan and derived and reconstituted from various old religions, and not necessarily Wiccan, but Windblown takes most of its roots from Gardnerian traditions. For the most part, Windblown covens keep the blessing of the darkness and light as I originally wrote it, or perhaps as it was transmitted by the universe to me. But many Windblown elders are gifted composers, writers, and channels of divine energy themselves, and some of them have made adaptations or completely rewritten entire rituals. And Windblown encourages that, so long as they acknowledge themselves as Windblown, follow a minimum of essentials, and were graduated from Windblown elders, they are Windblown. We even have an affiliated coven outside Windblown that is recognized as a Windblown sister coven. If you want to know more about that, you'll have to find out from Lord Tamlin. So there is a lot of flexibility within Windblown tradition. I want to stress that because my own personal religion, my spirituality, is Windblown, but not necessarily Wiccan. I want to honor the goddess and acknowledge her in many ways. And to make a start at that, and not be accused of cultural appropriation, I looked towards the practices of my own ancestors. How was I going to learn what those lost practices were? I am interested in the women's practices, not the ones that were documented by Hebrew law, but the ones that were undocumented or minimally documented. There is a good chance that the undocumented folk practices or folk customs that persisted in spite of being undocumented are remnants of goddess worship or pagan practices. But would they persist through thousands of years of monotheistic male domination? I don't know, but I have to start somewhere. There is also good reason to believe that acts that were specifically forbidden by Judaism were sacraments in the pagan religion. Two of the symbols of the paganism in all of Mesopotamia were the bull and the lion. In the Old Testament, the bull is called the golden calf. So I started reading about the cultural and religious practices of various peoples of ancient Mesopotamia. There were the Sumerians, the Akkadians, that is, the Babylonians, the Assyrians, the Canaanites, but none of them felt right to me until I found the Hittites. I have a love-hate relationship with the religion I learned from my family. Judaism, as it was practiced according to its own text, the Old Testament, leaves women out of the birth process entirely, right at the beginning, with the long ancestry begot list that specifically excludes mothers. The practice of polygamy, but not polyandry, was prevalent in their culture, which is why it is even more notable that the mothers were excluded from the ancestral lists. That and the division of labor commanded in Genesis is all I needed to know to realize I could not be Jewish. Judaism and the subsequent monotheisms that it spawned have worked hand in hand with politics to reinforce patriarchal culture and rule. The consequences of patriarchy, the fruits of this abomination, are evident all around us. On the other hand, the actual practices of cultural Judaism fostered and enabled female inventors and scientists, Mary the Jewess, Gertrude Elion, leaders Emma Goldman, Gertrude Wheel, Golda Meir, Bella Abzug, Betty Friedan, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Poets, Nellie Sachs, Denise Levertov, Emma Lazarus, and a larger percentage of leaders in witchcraft than could ever be attributed to random selection. Some of the contradictions between Jewish cultural heritage and the Judaism taught in Hebrew school have been explored by various authors. My favorite is a work of fiction entitled The Flame Bearers by Kim Chernin. It is only within the last 2 years that I have discovered that there were rabbis on both ancestral sides of my family. But let me circle back to Windblown for just a moment to make my point. Of all the elders in Windblown tradition, I am the only practicing Hittite. Oops! That may not be true. There may be one more. There are a couple other Windblown elders who have some Jewish ancestry, but their coven pantheons are not derived from Mesopotamia. Windblown tends to attract empaths and very highly functional autistic folk, possibly because I myself am in the latter category. If you think about it, it makes sense. Highly functioning autistic people know there is something different about them and have some sense, even if they have not been diagnosed, that other people have some knowledge or skill that helps them to cope socially. So they are attracted to empaths who have those skills in a highly developed form. And only other autistics and empaths will be tolerant of the special needs of autistics. Empaths, on the other hand, cultivate high adeptness in their empathic skills when interacting with autistics. It is not as much of a stretch for them as it would be for other people to interact socially with autistics, and if the other rewards are great enough, it can work well. But I'm talking of the olden days now, and Windblown tradition has since grown in ways that even I don't know completely. I wanted to make that point before I do a deep dive into Jew witchery and Hittites. I know that a significant percentage of you, my listeners, are not going to share my enthusiasm about Hittites. Don't worry. After this episode, you will hear about them less. But this is the appropriate time for me to bring forth some of my best research about Hittites. One of the things that used to bother me, as well as attract me, to Wicca was the simultaneous worship of god and goddess. There seemed to be something out of place for me in that, and yet it was something I valued. If you visit Greece, there was a temple to Aphrodite. There was a temple to Apollo. There was a temple to Athena. You know what you won't find in Greece? A temple to Hera and Zeus. In Greece, as in many ancient pagan religions, when you went to worship Zeus, you worshiped Zeus. You did not simultaneously worship Hera and Zeus, but you know who did? The Hittites. In Wicca, there is a saying that all gods are one god and all goddesses are one goddess. Well, not according to the Celts, nor the Norse, nor the Saxons, nor the Welsh. But you know which ancient pantheon comes closest to this? The Hittites. I don't want to mislead you because the reality is more complex, so I'll explain each of those statements. I visited a Hittite temple at Hattusis, where the main worship area had two great pedestals for the statues of the gods, one on each side of the podium area at the far end of the room. On one side, the rock was the podium that held the statue representing the goddess, and opposite her was a rock podium that held the statue of the god. The podiums were equal in size, but that was just one Hittite temple. There are other temples where the goddess and the gods were worshipped, not just simultaneously themselves, but themselves and their children as a family unit. I want to thank the late professor, Harry A. Hafner, Jr., for taking the time to clarify this for me in his letter, which I kept. And Hittite hymns that have been recovered and translated, frequently referenced the gods together as a couple or a family unit. You won't find much of that in other ancient pantheons. My second assertion, that the Hittites recognized all gods as one god and all goddesses as one goddess, also requires some caveats. First, I need to explain that the label Hittite has more than one meaning. In both cases, it refers to the people who lived in ancient Mesopotamia, especially the area we now know as Turkey, prior to 1000 BCE. But when we speak of Hittites, we could be identifying either a group of people who spoke a Proto-Indo-European language with Semitic and Sumerian borrow words, or we could be identifying the Hittites and their close neighbors who aligned themselves politically with the Indo-European-speaking Hittites. Those neighbors would include the Hattians, the Semitic Hurrians, who were in many ways culturally similar to Babylonians, except more egalitarian between the sexes, the Luwians, and the Amorites. Politically, the Hittites were a collection of small city-states, and each city-state had its own primary patron, goddess, and its own primary patron god, yes, one of each. The Hittites, who called themselves the people of a thousand gods, did so because they adopted and honored all the gods of their neighbors. The Hittites had a habit of synchronization of these state pantheons. This is best explained by example. In Arena, the Hittite capital, the sun goddess was known as Wurusemu, or Wurushemu, and the weather god, or storm god, was known as Taru. See page 112 of The Hittites by O. R. Gurney. And if you can think of a god of thunder and rain who is depicted in knee-length skirt, holding lightning in his left hand and a hatchet in his right hand, and if you think this might sound like Thor, so do I. In documents from Arena, where they referenced the gods of other city-states, those city-state primary pantheon deities were named as if saying, this is the name they use for the sun goddess at this location. They might refer to Hepat as the sun goddess of Aleppo. That indicated that Hepat was the patron goddess of Aleppo, and she might not necessarily be considered a sun goddess by the people of Aleppo themselves, but it was a way of denoting equivalency. Just as Teshub of Aleppo was known as the storm god of Aleppo. The Hittites were not united by a single pantheon. They recognized equivalencies between their deities of the Hittite capital and the surrounding city-state patron deities, but they did something else that was also unusual in the ancient world. They adapted and intermingled their religion with that of their neighbors and did so proudly. They observed religious practices and celebrated religious holidays of their neighbors with them. That may not exactly be all goddesses are one goddess and all gods are one god, but it gets pretty close. Tell me, can you think of another culture that so readily adopts the deities of its neighbors to the extent of celebrating their festivals and religious observations alongside their neighbors? Perhaps in Hindu India? The closest culture I can think of that even approaches that is modern neo-paganism. And now you know why I fell in love with the Hittites from the moment I found out about them. But there is more, so much more. From Hecate and Thor to Agni and Saraswati, Hittite god characteristics as well as god names match up. The Hurrian and Hattian peoples worshipped a mother goddess who they called Hepat or Hebat. In their language, the letter P and B were interchangeable. That is also true for the letters T and D. When Greeks invaded and raided the Hattian, Hurrian, Hittite lands, as they did periodically, they frequently captured young girls to take home to Greece to become slaves. When those young slave girls in Greece prayed to a goddess, their mother goddess Hepate was morphed into the vengeful Hecate. It was Hecate who helped Demeter retrieve her daughter Kore Persephone from Hades. And why was that? Because those Hurrian Hattian girl children slaves wanted nothing more than to return to their mothers. So Hepate, or Hebat, took the K from Kore to replace the PB and became Hecate. Two separate priesthoods existed side by side in ancient Hatti, the priests of the state and the old women. Hittite rulers sought the advice of each of those priesthoods for divination concerning matters of state. The term old women usually referred to a female priestess, but not always. There were also male old women. There is evidence that the old women priesthood was the older priesthood that came originally from either or both the Hattian and Hurrian peoples. The old women worked their magic either alone or with an assistant. They authored and recorded their own rituals, spells, herbal recipes, and magical potions. We know this because, unlike the Babylonians, the Hurrians taught girls as well as boys how to read and write, and also because the Hurrians and the Hittites had a standard protocol of signing their own documents. The old women recognized four quarters of the world, used salt for purifications, modeled figurines out of clay or wax or dough in human form to do sympathetic magic. They conjured familiars to guard their homes. They kept records of their herbal remedies. They burned sweet woods, especially cedar, as incense to appeal to the gods and favorable spirits. They burned asafoetida for banishing purposes, and they sealed their magical workings with a phrase that has been translated as "so be it." But in Hittite it is pronounced "is do," or as I like to say it, "yes, do." And now that I have presented about half of my case for why the Hittite pantheon and religion should be acknowledged by neo-pagans, yes, there is more that I will save for other episodes. I want to match up the Hittite-Jewish connection. History is his story, and the Bible certainly is his story. His story is written by the victors with lies and their own spin, propaganda. When you call bullpucky on that, your proclamation is labeled heresy, her essay. I need us to turn a critical eye on Genesis 23. Sarah lived to be 127 years old. She died in Hebron, in the land of Canaan, and Abraham mourned her death. Abraham goes to the Hittites and says, "I am a foreigner living here among you. Sell me some land so that I can bury my wife." Let's examine that for a second. Sarah dies in Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And most scholars agree that Abraham's original heritage was probably Canaanite. But instead of approaching Canaanites for Sarah's grave, Abraham approaches Hittites. Let that sink in for a moment. Surely there were also Canaanites in Hebron, in the land of Canaan. Abraham asserts, "I am a foreigner living here among you." That's interesting. In that assertion, Abraham says, "I am not Hittite. I am not of your people." And the Hittites respond, "We look upon you as a mighty leader. Bury your wife in the best grave that we have. Any of us would be glad to give you a grave so that you can bury her." And here is where I need to call bullpucky. The Hittites definitely do not say to Abraham that since he, Abraham, is such a great and wealthy man, that any of them would be glad to give his wife the best grave they have. If he was great and wealthy and offering to purchase land as a grave for his wife, they would have charged him a reasonable price, and that would be the end of it. So why do the Hittites offer to give Abraham land for free? Let me tell you how this conversation actually went. Abraham goes to the Hittites and not Canaanites, because that was Sarah's wish. In Genesis, Abraham and Sarah are called siblings, brother and sister, but later it is explained that they have the same father, Terah, but not the same mother. This is extremely important, and this fact, plus all its potential implications, have been explored thoroughly by Savina Tubal in her book, Sarah the Priestess, the First Matriarch of Genesis. I'm pretty sure that Sarah's mother was a Hurrian Hittite. Savina Tubal posits that Sarah was also the youngest daughter in a lineage of priestesshood. Sarah wanted to be buried with her own people, that is, her mother's lineage. And since Sarah was an important person among her own people, the Hittites offered to Abraham that Abraham could bury Sarah on Hittite land for free. Not only could he have buried Sarah on Hittite land for free, but any grave site, the best they had. But Abraham already knew the grave site he wanted for Sarah, because he doesn't hesitate at all when the Hittites offer him land. He not only knows what site he wants for Sarah's grave, but he knows who owns that site, Ephron. And when he asks Ephron if he can purchase the land, Ephron, who was probably part of Sarah's family lineage, offers to give that land to Abraham for Sarah's grave for free. But Abraham insists on purchasing the land. He purchases the Machpelah cave and the fields surrounding it and pays 400 silver pieces. By doing so, he satisfies the needs of two peoples. He satisfies the needs of the future Hebrews to have a grave for the mother of the Jewish people, and he satisfies the need for Sarah to be buried among the Hittites of her birth family. Every subsequent burial in that cave was either from Sarah's maternal bloodline or their male spouse. This upcoming full moon is also Purim. Both Purim and the spring equinox ritual that I have provided feature the theme of overcoming evil and greedy adversaries. In case it is not obvious, the participant who portrays the defeated adversary, that is, the person who portrays the dragon in the case of the Akitu ritual, serves a very important role. That person is standing in for the evil which needs to be defeated. That person needs to be strong enough and magically adept enough to redirect that energy where it needs to go, to reflect it off themselves and onto the appropriate target. At the feast, after the ritual, this person needs to be especially honored and recognized for taking on that role. In order to assist with that working, in the 12th episode, next week, I will be presenting a deep dive into magical shadow work and banishings. I would recommend that the person who portrays the defeated dragon to be adept at banishing, so that they do not absorb any blasting into themselves. If you are enjoying the Covening Podcast, and you are listening through Apple Podcasts, you have the ability to rate this podcast. Please give me a high rating. It will make it easier for Apple Podcast users to find the Covening Podcast. I would be happy to receive feedback, suggestions, and enhancement ideas from you. On the web, you can find me at covening.org and click on Contact. And share this podcast with your witchy friends. Thank you for those of you who are already doing so. Thank you all for joining me. Please tune in next week. Blessed be.
By the blade that cleaves the darkness and light, the babe from the mother, and the world of the living from the realms beyond, I carve a tunnel to the mortal realm. As common persons, we are masked until the circle be recast. Sacred ground remain unseen. Silence rules the worlds between. Till next we answer magic's call and meet together, witches all.